Diabetes Insights, Breakthroughs and Innovators. The EASD TV podcast from the annual meeting of the European Association for the Study of Diabetes.
You're watching EASD TV and we have a story time for you. There was a session which was on the story of GIP, and we have a splendid set of storytellers for you. We'll start with Michael Nack, and tell us where you work.
I work at the University of Bochum in Germany, and I'm responsible for clinical research in diabetes.
And I would say that you're the kind of godfather of GIP.
I'm not commenting.
Not commenting. And finally, Alice Adriansson's from UCL, and her research is focused on really the brain and GIP. So, Michael, start us off with GIP. When was it discovered? When did anybody think that it had any value at all?
So GIP is one of the two incretin hormones, and incretin hormones by definition are formed in and secreted from the gut after nutrient stimulation, and they are a signal traveling to the pancreas where the insulin-producing cells sit, and it tells them to secrete more insulin whenever the blood sugar is elevated, so like after a meal. This phenomenon was known for a long period of time. So the earliest experiments were published in 1906, I guess. But only after it became possible to measure insulin concentrations in blood, you could do real research in this area. And it was around the year 1970 that a Canadian biochemist, John Brown, discovered a peptide extracted from the gut, which at that time was called gastric inhibitory polypeptide, because it had an influence on gastric acid secretion in a certain animal model. This is not its real physiological function. The real physiological function is stimulating insulin secretion. And it does this very potently in healthy animals and humans.
So why was did GLP-1 get all the excitement?
So GLP-1 was discovered later. Maybe I should tell you the history of GIP to the point when GLP-1 appeared, because, well, in those days, these peptides, if you wanted to do experiments, were purified from tons of porcine gut. So that's a very tedious process. And so the initial experiment was in healthy animals and humans, very convincing stimulation of insulin secretion. And then it took like 15 years before enough GIP was produced to do the same experiments in patients with type 2 diabetes. So everyone talked about the fact that if you have something that stimulates insulin secretion, it might be a therapeutic for diabetes. And then came the big disappointment. In the same study, they examined healthy subjects and type 2 diabetic subjects. And again, wonderful effects in the healthy subjects, but almost negligible effects in type 2 diabetes. And that was just briefly before GLP-1 was detected in a much different way. It was discovered as the part of the nucleotide sequence coding for proglucagon. And so people knew there was that gene. That doesn't mean there needs to be a peptide. But then a few years later, people isolated the peptide and got the sequence correct. And it was active at picomolar concentration. So a very, very biologically active peptide. And then the same situation. It worked in healthy animals. Then came a study from Japan, and they said they examined GIP and GLP-1 in their animal model of type 2 diabetes, and it worked wonderfully in healthy animals. Neither of the two incretins worked in the diabetic animals. And at that time, I was working in the field, and we started a study mainly hoping to reproduce those findings. We just said it's not enough to know what they do in animals. We want to know how it is in a human situation. And then, to everyone's surprise, we saw that you had massive actions along the way of stimulating insulin secretion at moderate hyperglycemia with GLP-1. And then we did a very, very simple experiment infusing GLP-1. And our patients who had come to the hospital to start insulin treatment came on oral medications with a high blood sugar, 235 on average. And 4 hours after starting our infusion, the blood sugar was completely normal at 95 milligrams per deciliter. This is exactly the healthy, normal fasting glucose. And then it became evident that if you get some things right, this should be a wonderful therapeutic.
So now you have tirzepatide, which I'm afraid in the British press is always known as the gorilla of incretin-based therapies. And it's, you know, extraordinarily successful. Take us on with the next part of this of the story, Alice.
So I think what was really exciting about tirzepatide and the co-agonists in general is that they pointed towards a previously unrecognized aspect of GIP biology. And that was the fact that there could be this central component of GIP receptor signaling, which we hadn't really appreciated before. And so I think when in the first kind of preclinical studies, when we were looking at rodents and noticing that there was this effect on not just body weight, but also appetite suppression as well, that was kind of our first indicator. But then there was a really powerful study from Timo Müller and Matthias Chopp, who indicated that if you knock out GIPR from the CNS, that actually ablates the ability of these molecules to bring down body weight beyond a GLP-1 receptor agonist alone. So I think that was our first indication that there's something going on in the CNS. There had been data previously showing that GIP receptor is expressed in the brain, but I think it kind of got picked up and dropped in the same way that, you know, we kind of lost interest a little bit in GIP as a pharmacological target. So this kind of refocused, reinvigorated our attention on CNS signaling and GIP. And that's really where myself and other colleagues really jumped in to try and understand what is that neurocircuit where GIP may be acting and understanding where in the brain these GIP agents might also be binding.
So Michael, take us now to the future. What's going to be the key areas of inquiry with GIP, and where are the big gaps?
Well, the question how much GIP agonism contributes to the clinical effects you see with tirzepatide is not so important for tirzepatide. As you said, it's already a very successful drug and it will not be changed. But for the next generations, I think it is a very important question. Was that hypothesis correct? So should we also address the GIP receptor with molecules that can bind to several, two or three or more receptors? And I think I tended to say no until recently, but with the results presented at this meeting, it looks a little bit more robust. And of course, the contribution, for example, to insulin secretion is minor compared to that is contributed by GLP-1 receptor agonism. But it is there, and the effects seem to add up to what the whole molecule is able to do. We know, and Lilly is active in this field, that now we have clinical trials published on compounds that can specifically stimulate three receptors. So it's not GIP or glucagon. It is GLP-1, GIP, and glucagon. And the animal experiments show so far that if you stimulate the glucagon receptor, that this will increase energy expenditure. So this drug, other than GIP, GLP-1 co-agonists, does not only reduce appetite and energy intake, but it also makes the body spend more energy. And then the balance between energy intake and energy expenditure is more dialed towards weight loss, and more so with the stimulation of glucagon receptors. You don't see metabolic adaptation, which is a fatal physiological phenomenon that if you lose weight by restricting your calories, the energy expenditure will fall more than the body weight. That is always a force that will tend your body weight to go back to where it was before you started dieting. So it's probably very helpful to sustain weight loss over a long period of time. And there are other peptides that you can talk about. PYY is a very potent appetite inhibiting peptide from the gut. And I'm sure we'll see at least 100 different molecules that will be tried. And then we can sort out which of them will give us the best therapeutic results. And some will be disappointed because it's a lot of work. And just to find out our product is not competitive. So I feel sorry for those being in that situation. But some will be very much successful. And I anticipate that there will be as much competition as for the greatest effect size. This is going on right now. With this crowded market, I hope there will also be competition of providing good weight loss, good metabolic control, but without a lot of side effects. So we must admit some of these drugs still cause nausea and vomiting, and in 5 to 7%, the subjects decide they don't want to continue with this therapy. So we can improve a lot in this area.
So this is a wonderful story. You've come in at the towards the end of the story, but I think you've been very wise in picking GIP. And I suspect that you've got a very bright career ahead of you following that particular tale. I hope that you'll come back and tell us the next chapter. But as you've heard, it is a wonderful story. But speaking for myself, and I've written a book on hormones, they are always wonderful stories, the discoveries of hormones. So thank you all very much. And do come back again and tell us the next chapter, as I said. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back with you soon.
Thank you for joining us on the podcast of the European Association for the Study of Diabetes. We hope you enjoyed today's insights. If you did, go ahead and hit subscribe, and you'll always stay up to date with the latest in diabetes research and discoveries. And if you'd like to dive deeper, you can find plenty more information at easd.org.